3, 2, 1. As a company, WorldPlus Inc. specializes in buying and reselling airline coupons, and the company has attracted many affluent clients, such as doctors and lawyers. While profits can be good, financial advisors warn the airline coupon is a volatile market that rides up and down with airline price wars, and it's grown riskier as airlines tighten down on who can cash in on bonus miles. Indeed, 2 years ago, Delta Airlines slapped an injunction on WorldPlus Incorporated, forbidding them to resell the airline's coupons, and Delta is still seeking damages. But more recent events have some investors going to court to protect their investments and returns. This September, the Alaska Department of Commerce yanked WorldPlus's corporate status. Mike Monago is with the state's Division of Banking and Securities.
WorldPlus Inc. was dissolved involuntarily for failure to file a 1995, what we call biannual report and tax, which is something that all corporations have to file with our agency once every 2 years. Once they become 6 months delinquent, the state has given grounds to dissolve and then takes that action.
And Wednesday, responding to investor fears and possible improprieties, the state essentially put a halt to any new investments by WorldPlus. Larry Carroll, senior securities examiner, says because WorldPlus had promised to cater to only 15 Alaska clients and restrict total investments to $250,000, the company was exempt from some reporting requirements.
Recently, information has come to the division that suggests that perhaps those limitations may have been exceeded, that reports that were to have been filed to us may have been less than accurate with respect to the numbers of investors or the amounts invested. We've decided to restrict her ability to offer any new promissory notes or to take any new investment funds until we have an opportunity to examine this more carefully.
And at least three investors are trying to regain money through district court. Jerry Sadler says WorldPlus and its owner, Regine Bonham, owe him close to $400,000. Despite his lawsuit, Sadler says he's confident he'll get paid.
WorldPlus might have had some circumstances beyond their control, and she's assured me that she will make any debt owed me good. She's been in business in Fairbanks for 8 to 10 years that I know of. Nobody that I know of has lost one nickel with her.
Regine Bonham has declined to respond to calls or answer questions. But in court documents, she says she fell behind in her payments to investors because the IRS took $150,000 from her account and that a coupon broker stung her for an additional $180,000. The court papers also show she lied to at least one of her investors. Court dates are still pending in the lawsuits, and the state says it expects a full disclosure of WorldPlus's financial status. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
3, 2, 1. Last month, federal workers came to the office for a few hours so their bosses could tell them to go back home. This time, many were told Friday to stay home today unless they hear otherwise. But as this latest work stoppage begins, the furloughs are promising to cause problems. Sam Domenech, superintendent of the Fairbanks Bureau of Indian Affairs, says students going to school with BIA support may find themselves stranded.
They're out in the lower 48 or someplace else in Alaska, and they're trying to travel home, especially at this time during Christmas vacation. If they were promised to be able to come home, there's no one here at the office. There's no one for them to contact. There's no one for them to talk to as far as getting back home. So those people are pretty much left wherever they are.
Domenech says the shutdown will affect about 20 students in BIA programs. And unlike some other government agencies, the shutdown directly affects people who depend on government services. Closing agencies like the Park Service will also affect people, though in a different way. Denali Park spokeswoman Jane Trunnell says the shutdown interferes with important off-season work.
We have so much to do this time of year getting ready for summer. They end up working at home on various projects, but we ended up getting losing a lot of time, really, to prepare for a very busy summer season here at Denali. Our reservation systems go online in January, and basically the result is we lose valuable time getting ready for visitors from around the country and around the world.
Although workers have been told not to take assignments home, Chernell says some will violate that order to keep projects moving. Over at the BLM, employees were prepped Friday for the latest layoff, including receiving paperwork for filing unemployment insurance claims, just in case they don't get paid from this latest go-around. BLM spokeswoman Sharon Wilson says employees have learned from the last furlough, and they've tallied up a list of people who are inconvenienced.
We serve a great deal of public that comes in looking for land status, researching mining claims, looking for native land claim settlements, and we found that there was quite a bit of work that didn't get done during the 4 days we were off on furlough.
Wilson says that includes delaying approvals for assessment work done on mining claims. She's advising miners who are used to stopping into the office to instead mail in their paperwork, just to ensure a postmark before December 30th will prove they met their filing deadline. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
3, 2, 1. In the summer of 1953, a team of scientists established a 14,000-foot-high observation camp atop Mount Wrangell. They meant to measure cosmic rays hitting the high north. But Bucky Wilson, one of the scientists, says they spent much of their time surviving in howling blizzards. University of Alaska President Terrace Moore originally flew the team with tents to the base camp. Then researchers waited for 19 tons of support material dropped from military C-124 cargo planes.
In that equipment, there were several Jamesway huts, which are portable huts that could be erected on the snow. And the first thing that we did after living through one of these severe storms in which about 4 feet of snow was deposited, when the airdrops came in, we immediately went first to the Jamesway huts and set them up right on a slope, actually, just to have a place to survive in. And it that may sound like a dramatic word, but when tents blow apart up on top of a mountain, it becomes a survival situation.
Wilson says despite its brutal weather, Mount Wrangell was chosen for its large icebound landing site and for its high altitude and latitude. From earlier research, scientists knew that cosmic radiation spiraled into the poles along the Earth's magnetic field. To get a good picture of incoming radiation, scientists had to place equipment high enough so that the cosmic particles weren't filtered by too much atmosphere. Wilson says the hazards of this kind of research actually attracted a certain kind of scientist.
In those early days at the Geophysical Institute, a lot of people had come to Alaska to work there because of the romance of the mountains and the possibility that, you know, while working as a physicist, they might be able to go climb a mountain or two.
Wrangell proved to be an important research site, not just for cosmic rays, but for glaciology, high-altitude physiology, and volcanology. In fact, Wilson says the 1964 earthquake changed the mountain's plumbing, releasing volcanic fumes that melted about 600 feet of snow and stopped ski planes from landing. The sulfuric steam all but killed the site for research. Wilson and another pioneering researcher, Carl Benson, will talk about their experiences atop Mount Wrangell Tuesday night at the Noel Wien Public Library Auditorium at 7:30. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
As Christmas gets closer, people at the Fairbanks Community Food Bank are marveling at the year they've had. Thanksgiving week this year, they packed and distributed almost 500 food boxes. Food Bank Executive Director Samantha Castle says just 5 years ago, they put together only 75 boxes in Thanksgiving week.
Someone told me that every time they turn around, they see a canned food drive, and it's true. We've been asking and asking the community. The community has provided wonderfully. We have food resources available. Over the past year, the food bank has been able to collect 1.5 million pounds of local surplus food, and that's up considerably over years past.
Over 8,000 households have needed food boxes in 1995. That's about a fifth of the local population. Castle says three-quarters of the boxes they pack go to families with two or three children, the rest to single adults. There have been so many requests this year that for the first time in its 14-year history, the food bank has had to set limits. They figure they can pack 40 boxes a day without overextending their volunteers, staff, and their work area.
But these are tough times, and it's not just the food bank, of course. It's Breadline Rescue Mission, all of the groups that will have more demand for service, because as dollars are cut back to individuals, then oftentimes they have no other recourses or haven't prepared themselves for the event.
Cutbacks at the federal level have already affected the food bank. In October, it lost a $50,000 grant it has received routinely for the past 5 years. But as Congress prepares to turn assistance programs over to the states, Castle says she's optimistic.
I think that ultimately the state will be able to do an excellent job of handling the block grant funds and distributing them fairly through the state, and I'm looking forward to working with the Commissioner of Health and Social Services on that project.
She says the transition from federal to state is bound to be difficult, and she doesn't see an end to it for at least 2 years. But in the meantime, the director of the food bank calls this the rainy day she's been getting ready for. The Fairbanks Community Food Bank staff and volunteers are still packing boxes for Christmas. 99 boxes were packed yesterday alone. And Castle says while they've got plenty of trimmings, they're in need of hams and turkeys. The food bank will be open until 5 today and from 10 to 4 tomorrow. They're at 517 Gaffney Road. They'll be closed all day Sunday. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
Three, two, one. World Plus Incorporated has been buying and selling airline coupons for several years, returning big profits to investors. But the business is collapsing, leaving the investors facing sizable losses. This week, to stop a proliferation of lawsuits against the business, three creditors got together and asked a federal judge to place the owner, Fairbanks and Regine Bonham, in involuntary bankruptcy. Larry Compton is the interim trustee.
The purpose of the filing of this bankruptcy was to stop the rush of claims in this case for a return of the investment. And there were some state court cases filed, and assets were beginning to be attached. And if it was not for the bankruptcy, those people that filed first would have been paid first. And in this case, through the bankruptcy process, it affords everybody the opportunity of being, everyone that files a claim, an opportunity to be to share equally in whatever assets are available.
Because the bankruptcy was involuntary, Bonham has not left a list of creditors. Compton says he suspects the collapse has snared hundreds of World Plus investors.
I don't think at this time I can give an accurate amount. It is probably in the hundreds. Many Alaskans, the majority in Fairbanks, there are investors throughout the state and at least a dozen other states.
State securities investigator Larry Carroll says officials are trying to determine just how big this case is. He says World Plus originally promised to stay small, catering to just 15 Alaskan clients and restricting total investments to $250,000. But Carroll says investigators now believe World Plus was handling millions.
First of all, we're trying to get a measure of exactly how much has been invested and try and get an idea of the liability of this company, how many people are out there, how much money they've put in, and what kind of assets are available to satisfy the debt.
When Larry Compton was appointed trustee for World Plus, he had the option to continue business on behalf of the investors, but says after reviewing operations and records, he's decided to shut it down. Meanwhile, in Fairbanks, worried investors were flocking to file their claims with the U.S. Bankruptcy Court. Compton hopes to schedule a meeting with them sometime in January. Continued efforts to reach Bonham this week were unsuccessful. With Susan McInnes, I'm John McWhorter in Fairbanks.
Maybe it's because I've recently seen the movie Outbreak and just read the book The Hot Zone, but I'm beginning to see some disturbing parallels between the Ebola virus and Christmas music. No, wait a minute. Think about this. What is a virus? It's an opportunistic strip of RNA and protein that can't reproduce without insinuating itself into your body. And what is a Christmas tune? It's an opportunistic strip of sharps, flats, and naturals that can't reproduce without insinuating itself into your body. In this case, your ear canal. Think of this little ditty as the source of infection. Now, say some unsuspecting guy like, my office mate, John McWhorter, goes to a mall for lunch. Without a thought in his head, he passes under the speaker, chirping out Leroy Anderson's Sleigh Ride. At once, the tune begins coiling its way insidiously into his synapses. By the time he's back in the office... The tune is making copy after copy of itself, just like a virus, and soon it spreads. And even I'm not safe. In no time, office after office in the building is overrun. Now, here's the clinching proof there is something viral in Christmas music. It's not long before mutation sets in. Actually, thanks to evolutionary theory, when a mutant tune arises, it's not likely to survive long. And it usually signals the outbreak has run its course. The only problem is, at this time of year, another epidemic is not far off. Hoping your inoculations are in order this season, I'm Robert Hannon.
Carbon monoxide cuts off the oxygen we need to survive. When it's breathed in, cells looking for oxygen grab carbon monoxide instead, and if there's no relief from it, we die. At low levels, it causes dizziness and headaches. Environmental Protection Agency air quality specialist John Pavitt says in a confined space like a small plane, a concentration of CO will bring on severe headaches, nausea, dizziness, ringing in the ears, and will put the pilot in danger.
In the open air, the types of concentrations you see just on the street level would never approach that that high level. But relatively high levels of carbon monoxide at street level are thought to affect people more strongly who have heart conditions, who the pregnant population, the elderly, people with respiratory or heart ailments.
The street level is where most of us experience carbon monoxide, mostly from the tailpipes of cars and trucks. The EPA considers 9 parts per million a relatively high open-air dose, and while healthy adults might not even notice that, folks with heart or lung problems, young children, or people with sickle cell anemia could. In the 70s, both Fairbanks and Anchorage were regularly hitting carbon monoxide levels you might expect to breathe in a mechanic shop, not on a city street. In the winter of 74, Fairbanks violated federal air quality standards 168 times. But Ron King, chief of air quality improvement at the state's Division of Environmental Conservation, says Alaska's largest cities have cleaned up their acts considerably.
There's no question in my mind in which the citizens of Fairbanks and Anchorage are to be commended for their efforts over the last 20 years. You look in the early 70s with CO concentrations in the high 20s and 30s in the two communities to where they are today, 10, 11 parts per million, there's been some tremendous strides.
The EPA's John Pavitt agrees. The improvements, he says, have much to do with what we're driving and what we're not.
Older cars were retired and newer cars came on the road. Newer cars are much cleaner burning. In those 10 years, many communities started inspection and maintenance programs so that the grossly polluting vehicles, the vehicles that are seriously out of tune, were spotted. Those cars got tuned up, and those two programs together really helped to bring down carbon monoxide.
Ron King says people are also more aware and more concerned about the air they breathe.
Plugging their cars in when the temperature is 0 to 20 degrees above is important. It will help reduce emissions. It's actually good for the car to keep the block warm and the lubricants warm, not just at the sub-zero temperatures, but 0 to 20.
In 1990, 42 American cities failed to meet national air quality standards. By 1993, only 9 cities were reporting air quality violations, but Fairbanks and Anchorage were among them. This year, Anchorage is probably going off the bad air list, but Fairbanks, which battles winter inversions along with vehicle emissions, has not done quite as well. It's logged a half dozen violations in 1995. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis. Oil production and oil handling facilities and power plants probably account for a quarter to a half of Alaska's air pollution. Automobiles likely contribute another 50%. But John Pavitt, air quality specialist with the Environmental Protection Agency, says it's not just what pollutes, but the way pollution plays itself out in the state that makes Alaska unique.
We certainly have areas of high population density and vast areas of unpopulated lands where you get a real contrast in the types of pollution. This is something that makes us different from the lower 48.
And even what pollutes really depends on where you look. There's hardly any traffic on the North Slope, but there are large oil production facilities.
And so your large facilities would account for a bigger share. Other places like Anchorage, which don't have a lot of industry but have a lot of vehicles, automobiles would take up a bigger proportion of the total air pollution going into the air.
Meteorology also governs air quality in Alaska, and it may be the most influential factor of all. Persistent winds disperse pollutants on the North Slope, and wind, moist air, and clouds regularly improve the air over Anchorage. In the interior, winter days tend to be cold and still. UAF chemist Rich Benner says mountains and hills block the wind near Fairbanks, and inversions hold cold winter air and pollutants close to the ground.
And what happens with the inversion, because we have very low humidity levels, generally clear skies, the heat from the earth radiates out off into space, and that causes cool air to form right at the surface. Because there's no wind to blow or that cold air around or to mix it, it just keeps building up from the ground level upward.
Ironically, ice fog, the thing that looks the worst, helps break up the interior's inversions. As ice fog thickens and carries the cold air away from the ground, it also carries trapped pollutants up into the atmosphere.
And that helps mix the pollutants through a larger volume of the atmosphere, and so we don't get the pollutant levels that we would without the ice fog.
Inversions aren't unique to Fairbanks. Other American cities with air quality problems, like Phoenix, Denver, and Los Angeles, also have inversions. Benner says the difference is severity.
Our inversions are much more intense, and they can last several days, whereas in places like Phoenix, that inversion is broken up every day, and so they get a daily flushing, so to speak, of their pollution from the area, whereas ours can sit for sometimes days or weeks.
Valdez also experiences inversion. Cold air slides down off the hills and settles into the bowl where the town and harbor are, and among other things, it traps hydrocarbons there. Like Fairbanks, Valdez has a geography and meteorology that makes it more susceptible to air quality problems. Air quality and what determines it is a little different depending on where you look and what you look at in Alaska, and the result seems to be cumulative. Emissions with population, geography, and meteorology collectively contributing to the air we breathe. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis. In 1992, Congress mandated the use of oxyfuels in an effort to clean up carbon monoxide emissions on America's streets and highways. But when an oxyfuel called MTBE was pumped at Fairbanks gas stations, the reaction was anything but welcoming. People complained of headaches and nausea, shortness of breath, and other distresses. A local radio station set up a hotline for complaints and received over 500 calls. And a citizens group, nicknamed the Oxybusters, went to work to get oxyfuels out of town. North Star Borough Air Quality Specialist Kent Monroe says since then, Alaska's congressional delegation has worked to keep oxyfuels out.
Our Alaska delegation has worked in the last couple of years to actually get provisions passed that we don't here in Fairbanks have to implement any type of ethanol program or oxyfuel program. Due primarily to, I guess, a lot of questions that remain about the effectiveness of those additives in Fairbanks' climate, and also some lingering health questions that remain about using those additives in our fuel.
Some of those questions are now being settled as the results come in on a series of Arctic winter tests of ethanol. 250 Fairbanksons participated in the studies, as did drivers in Anchorage. Grace Eglund is program manager with environmental health in the state's Office of Epidemiology. She says they looked at whether pumping ethanol instead of gas raised the level of chemical exposure in the bloodstream.
When people go to the gas pump, there are some exposures that occur to benzene, ethylbenzene, n-p-xylene, and toluene. And what we did was we recruited people who were in the drivability study in Fairbanks to provide blood prior to pumping gas and then after pumping gas, and then we could look at the increase to see that the using the E10 fuel in Fairbanks won't change their exposures. And that's basically what the study found.
Eglund says the chemicals we breathe in when driving or pumping gas don't seem much different whether we use ethanol or gasoline. Either way, she says, it's best to avoid breathing fumes.
And if you can move away from the vehicle when you're refueling, that's good. But we have no reason to make people alarmed about the exposures. These are very small exposures, less than one part per billion. It's similar to like 3 tablespoons in 12.5 million gallons of gasoline, so it's a low exposure.
The distress that underlay the Fairbanks protest may not be fully put to rest. Lad McBride, secretary-treasurer of Alaska Watch, a citizens group concerned about oxyfuels, says limited studies of additives don't provide the kind of certainty his group is looking for.
We're going to have to know. We're going to have a unanimous decision by our accepted scientists and doctors that there will be no health problems with what we're using. To date, they have not come out and said these will not hurt you under any circumstances.
Although the results of the drivability study won't be published until mid-January, preliminary reports show that cars using ethanol didn't stall out any more frequently than gas-powered cars when temperatures hit 30 and 40 below. Emissions tests and a study of odor are also winding up. Those reports are due out in the next few months. With these studies showing little difference between ethanol and gasoline under Arctic conditions, the oxyfuel may be introduced in Fairbanks after all. Anchorage drivers have been using it since 1994. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.